The street was dark now. He looked up at the window once more, and he saw the strange woman and the man and the child in a group together. The emptiness spread in him. All was gone. Antonopoulos was away. He was not here to remember. The thoughts of his friend were somewhere else. Singer shut his eyes and tried to think of the asylum and the room that Antonopoulos was in tonight. He remembered the narrow white beds and the old men playing slapjack in the corner. He held his eyes shut tight, but that room would not become clear in his mind. The emptiness was very deep inside him, and after a while he glanced up at the window once more and started down the dark sidewalk where they had walked together so many times. It was Saturday night. The main street was thick with people. Shivering Negroes in overalls loitered before the windows of the 10-cent store. Families stood in line before the ticket box of the movie, and young boys and girls stared at the posters on display outside. The traffic from the automobiles was so dangerous that he had to wait a long time before crossing the street. He passed the fruit store. The fruits were beautiful inside the windows, bananas, oranges, alligator pears, bright little kumquats, and even a few pineapples. But Charles Parker waited on a customer inside. The face of Charles Parker was very ugly to him. Several times when Charles Parker was away, he had entered the store and stood around a long while. He had even gone to the kitchen in the back where Antonopoulos made the candies. But he never went into the store while Charles Parker was inside. They had both taken care to avoid each other since that day when Antonopoulos left on the bus. When they met in the street, they always turned away without nodding. Once, when he had wanted to send his friend a jar of his favorite Tupelo honey, he had ordered it from Charles Parker by mail so as not to be obliged to meet him. Singer stood before the window and watched the cousin of his friend wait on a group of customers. Business was always good on Saturday night. Antonopoulos sometimes had to work as late as 10 o'clock. The big automatic popcorn popper was near the door. A clerk shoved in a measure of kernels, and the corn whirled inside the case like giant flakes of snow. The smell from the store was warm and familiar. Peanut holes were trampled on the floor. Singer passed on down the street. He had to weave his way carefully in the crowds to keep from being jostled. The streets were strung with red and green electric lights because of the holidays. People stood in laughing groups with their arms about each other. Young fathers nursed cold and crying babies on their shoulders. A Salvation Army girl in her red and blue bonnet tinkled a bell on the corner. And when she looked at Singer, he felt obliged to drop a coin into the pot beside her. There were beggars, both Negro and white, who held out caps or crusty hands. The neon advertisements cast an orange glow on the faces of the crowd. He reached the corner where he and Antonopoulos had once seen a mad dog on an August afternoon. Then he passed the room above the Army and Navy store where Antonopoulos had had his picture taken every payday. He carried many of the photographs in his pocket now. He turned west toward the river. Once they had taken a picnic lunch and crossed the bridge and eaten in a field on the other side. Singer walked along the main street for about an hour. In all the crowd, he seemed the only one alone. At last, he took out his watch and turned toward the house where he lived. Perhaps one of the people would come this evening to his room. He hoped so. He mailed Antonopoulos a large box of presents for Christmas. Also, he presented gifts to each of the 4 people and to Mrs. Kelly. For all of them together, he had bought a radio and put it on the table by the window. Dr. Copeland did not notice the radio. Biff Brannan noticed it immediately and raised his eyebrows. Jake Blunt kept it turned on all the time he was there, at the same station, and as he talked he seemed to be shouting above the music, for the veins stood out on his forehead. Mick Kelly did not understand when she saw the radio. Her face was very red, and she asked him over and over if it was really his and whether she could listen. She worked with a dial for several minutes before she got it to the place that suited her. She sat leaning forward in her chair with her hands on her knees, her mouth open, and a pulse beating very fast in her temple. She seemed to listen all over to whatever it was she heard. She sat there the whole afternoon, and when she grinned at him once, her eyes were wet, and she rubbed them with her fists. She asked him if she could come in and listen sometimes when he was at work, and he nodded yes. So for the next few days, whenever he opened the door, he found her by the radio. Her hand raked through her short, rumpled hair, and there was a look in her face he had never seen before. One night, soon after Christmas, all four of the people chanced to visit him at the same time. This had never happened before. Singer moved about the room with smiles and refreshments and did his best in the way of politeness to make his guests comfortable. But something was wrong. Dr. Copeland would not sit down. He stood in the doorway, hat in hand, and only bowed coldly to the others. They looked at him as though they wondered why he was there. Jake Blunt opened the beers he had brought with him, and the foam spilled down on his shirt front. Mick Kelly listened to the music from the radio. Biff Brannan sat on the bed, his knees crossed, his eyes scanning the group before him, and then becoming narrow and fixed. Singer was bewildered. Always each of them had so much to say, yet now that they were together, they were silent. When they came in, he had expected an outburst of some kind. In a vague way, he had expected this to be the end of something. But in the room, there was only a feeling of strain. His hands worked nervously as though they were pulling things unseen from the air and binding them together. Jake Blunt stood beside Dr. Copeland. "I know your face. We ran into each other once before on the steps outside." Dr. Copeland moved his tongue precisely as though he clipped out his words with scissors. "I was not aware that we were acquainted," he said. Then his stiff body seemed to shrink. He stepped back until he was just outside the threshold of the room. Biff Brannan smoked his cigarette composedly. The smoke lay in thin layers across the room. He turned to Mick, and when he looked at her, a blush reddened his face. He half closed his eyes, and in a moment, his face was bloodless once more. "And how are you getting on with your business now?" "What business?" Mick asked suspiciously. "Just the business of living," he said. "School, and so forth." "Okay, I reckon," she said. Each one of them looked at Singer as though in expectation. He was puzzled. He offered refreshments and smiled. Jake rubbed his lips with the palm of his hand. He left off trying to make conversation with Dr. Copeland and sat down on the bed beside Biff.
"You know who it is that used to write those bloody warnings in red chalk on the fences and walls around the mills?"
"No," Biff said. "What bloody warnings?"
"Mostly from the Old Testament. I've been wondering about that for a long time."
Each person addressed his words mainly to the mute. Their thoughts seemed to converge in him as the spokes of a wheel lead to the center hub.
"The cold has been very unusual," Biff said finally. "The other day I was looking through some old records, and I found that in the year 1919, the thermometer got down to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. It was only 16 degrees this morning, and that's the coldest since the big freeze that year."
"There were icicles hanging off the roof of the coal house this morning," Mick said.
"We didn't take in enough money last week to meet the payroll," Jake said.
They discussed the weather some more. Each one seemed to be waiting for the others to go. Then on an impulse, they all rose to leave at the same time. Dr. Copeland went first, and the others followed him immediately. When they were gone, Singer stood alone in the room, and as he did not understand the situation, he wanted to forget it. He decided to write to Antonopoulos that night. The fact that Antonopoulos could not read did not prevent Singer from writing to him. He had always known that his friend was unable to make out the meaning of words on paper, but as the months went by, he began to imagine that perhaps he had been mistaken, that perhaps Antonopoulos only kept his knowledge of letters a secret from everyone. Also, it was possible there might be a deaf-mute at the asylum who could read his letters and then explain them to his friend. He thought of several justifications for his letters, for he always felt a great need to write to his friend when he was bewildered or sad. Once written, however, these letters were never mailed. He cut out the comic strips from the morning and evening papers and sent them to his friend each Sunday, and every month he mailed a postal money order. But the long letters he wrote to Antonopoulos accumulated in his pockets until he would destroy them. When the four people had gone, Singer slipped on his warm gray overcoat and his gray felt hat and left his room. He always wrote his letters at the store. Also, he had promised to deliver a certain piece of work the next morning, and he wanted to finish it now so that there would be no question of delay. The night was sharp and frosty. The moon was full and rimmed with a golden light. The rooftops were black against the starlit sky. As he walked, he thought of ways to begin his letter, but he had already reached the store before the first sentence was clear in his mind. He let himself into the dark store with his key and switched on the front lights. He worked at the very end of the store. A cloth curtain separated his place from the rest of the shop so that it was like a small private room. Besides his workbench and chair, there was a heavy safe in the corner, a lavatory with a greenish mirror, and shelves full of boxes and worn-out clocks. Singer rolled up the top of his bench and removed from its felt case the silver platter he had promised to have ready. Although the store was cold, he took off his coat and turned up the blue-striped cuffs of his shirt so that they would not get in his way. For a long time, he worked at the monogram in the center of the platter. With delicate, concentrated strokes, he guided the scriver on the silver. As he worked, his eyes had a curiously penetrating look of hunger. He was thinking of his letter to his friend Antonopoulos. Midnight had passed before the work was finished. When he put the platter away, his forehead was damp with excitement. He cleared his bench and began to write. He loved to shape words with a pen on paper, and he formed the letters with as much care as if the paper had been a plate of silver. My only friend. I see from our magazine that the Society meets this year at a convention in Macon. They will have speakers and a four-course banquet. I imagine it. Remember, we always planned to attend one of the conventions, but we never did. I wish now that we had. I wish we were going to this one, and I have imagined how it would be. But of course, I could never go without you. They will come from many states, and they will be all full of words and long dreams from the heart. There is also to be a special service at one of the churches and some kind of a contest with a gold medal for the prize. I write that I imagine all this. I both do and do not. My hands have been still so long that it is difficult to remember how it is. And when I imagine the convention, I think of all the guests being like you, my friend. I stood before our home the other day. Other people live in it now. Do you remember the big oak tree in front? The branches were cut back so as not to interfere with the telephone wires, and the tree died. The limbs are rotten, and there is a hollow place in the trunk. Also, the cat here at the store, the one you used to stroke and fondle, ate something poisonous and died. It was very sad. Singer held the pen poised above the paper. He sat for a long while, erect and tense, without continuing the letter. Then he stood up and lighted himself a cigarette. The room was cold, and the air had a sour, stale odor, the mixed smells of kerosene and silver polish and tobacco. He put on his overcoat and muffler and began writing again with slow determination. You remember the four people I told you about when I was there? I drew their pictures for you, the black man, the young girl, the one with the mustache, and the man who owns the New York Cafe. There are some things I should like to tell you about them, but how to put them in words, I am not sure. They are all very busy people. In fact, they are so busy that it will be hard for you to picture them. I do not mean that they work at their jobs all day and night, but that they have much business in their minds, always, but does not let them rest. They come up to my room and talk to me, until I do not understand how a person can open and shut his or her mouth so much without being weary. However, the New York cafe owner is different. He is not just like the others. He has a very black beard, so that he has to shave twice daily, and he owns one of these electric razors. He watches. The others all have something they hate, and they all have something they love more than eating or sleeping or wine or friendly company. That is why they are always so busy. The one with the mustache, I think, is crazy. Sometimes he speaks his words very clear, like my teacher long ago at the school. Other times he speaks such a language that I cannot follow. Sometimes he is dressed in a plain suit, and the next time he will be black with dirt and smelling bad and in the overalls he wears to work. He will shake his fist and say ugly, drunken words that I would not wish you to know about. He thinks he and I have a secret together, but I do not know what it is. And let me write you something hard to believe. He can drink 3 pints of Happy Days whiskey and still talk and walk on his feet and not wish for the bed. You will not believe this, but it is true. I rent my room from the girl's mother for $16 per month. The girl used to dress in short trousers like a boy, but now she wears a blue skirt and blouse. She is not yet a young lady. I like her to come and see me. She comes all the time now that I have a radio for them. She likes music. I wish I knew what it is she hears. She knows I am deaf, but she thinks I know about music. The black man is sick with consumption, but there is not a good hospital for him to go to here because he is black. He is a doctor, and he works more than anyone I have ever seen. He does not talk like a black man at all. Other Negroes I find it hard to understand because their tongues do not move enough for the words. This black man frightens me sometimes. His eyes are hot and bright. He asked me to a party, and I went. He has many books. However, he does not own any mystery books. He does not drink or eat meat or attend the movies.
"Yeah, freedom and pirates. Yeah, capital and Democrats," says the ugly one with the mustache. Then he contradicts himself and says, "Freedom is the greatest of all ideals."
I just gotta get a chance to write this music in me and be a musician. I gotta have a chance, says the girl.
"We are not allowed to serve," says the black doctor. "That is the godlike need for my people."
"Aha," says the owner of the New York cafe. He is a thoughtful one. That is the way they talk when they come to my room. Those words in their heart do not let them rest, so they are always very busy. Then you would think when they are together they would be like those of the society who meet at the convention in Macon this week, but that is not so. They all came to my room at the same time today. They sat like they were from different cities. They were even rude. And you know how I have always said that to be rude and not attend to the feelings of others is wrong. So it was like that. I do not understand. So I write it to you because I think you will understand. I have queer feelings, but I have written of this matter enough, and I know you are weary of it. I am also. It has been 5 months and 21 days now. All of that time I have been alone without you. The only thing I can imagine is when I will be with you again. If I cannot come to you soon, I do not know what. Singer put his head down on the bench and rested. The smell and the feel of the slick wood against his cheek reminded him of his school days. His eyes closed, and he felt sick. There was only the face of Antonopoulos in his mind, and his longing for his friend was so sharp that he held his breath. After some time, Singer sat up and reached for his pen. "The gift I ordered for you did not come in time for the Christmas box. I expect it shortly. I believe you will like it and be amused. I think of us always and remember everything. I long for the food you used to make. At the New York cafe,
It is much worse than it used to be. I found a cooked fly in my soup not long ago. It was mixed with the vegetables and the noodles like letters. But that is nothing. The way I need you is a loneliness I cannot bear. Soon I will come again. My vacation is not due for 6 months more, but I think I can arrange it before then. I think I will have to. I am not meant to be alone and without you, who understand. Always, John Singer. It was 2 o'clock in the morning before he was home again. The big, crowded house was in darkness, but he felt his way carefully up 3 flights of stairs and did not stumble. He took from his pockets the cards he carried about with him, his watch, and his fountain pen. Then he folded his clothes neatly over the back of his chair. His gray flannel pajamas were warm and soft. Almost as soon as he pulled the blankets to his chin, he was asleep. Out of the blackness of sleep, a dream formed. There were dull yellow lanterns lighting up a dark flight of stone steps. Antonopoulos kneeled at the top of these steps. He was naked, and he fumbled with something that he held above his head and gazed at as though in prayer. He himself knelt halfway down the steps. He was naked and cold, and he could not take his eyes from Antonopoulos and the thing he held above him. Behind him on the ground, he felt the one with the mustache, and the girl, and the black man, and the last one. They knelt naked, and he felt their eyes on him. And behind them, there were uncounted crowds of kneeling people in the darkness. His own hands were huge windmills, and he stared, fascinated, at the unknown thing that Antonopoulos held. The yellow lantern swayed to and fro in the darkness, and all else was motionless. Then suddenly, there was a ferment. In the upheaval, the steps collapsed, and he felt himself falling downward. He awoke with a jerk. The early light whitened the window. He felt afraid. Such a long time had passed that something might have happened to his friend. Because Antonopoulos did not write to him, he would not know. Perhaps his friend had fallen and hurt himself. He felt such an urge to be with him once more that he would arrange it at any cost immediately. In the post office that morning, he found a notice in his box that a package had come for him. It was the gift he had ordered for Christmas that did not arrive in time. The gift was a very fine one. He had bought it on the installment plan to be paid for over a period of 2 years. The gift was a moving picture machine for private use, with a half dozen of the Mickey Mouse and Popeye comedies that Antonopoulos enjoyed. Singer was the last to reach the store that morning. He handed the jeweler for whom he worked a formal written request for leave on Friday and Saturday, and although there were 4 weddings on hand that week, the jeweler nodded that he could go. He did not let anyone know of the trip beforehand, but on leaving, he tacked a note to his door saying that he would be absent for several days because of business. He traveled at night, and the train reached the place of his destination just as the red winter dawn was breaking. In the afternoon, a little before time for the visiting hour, he went out to the asylum. His arms were loaded with the parts of the moving picture machine and the basket of fruit he carried for his friend. He went immediately to the ward where he had visited Antonopoulos before. The corridor, the door, the rows of beds were just as he remembered them. He stood at the threshold and looked eagerly for his friend. But he saw at once that though all the chairs were occupied, Antonopoulos was not there. Singer put down his packages and wrote at the bottom of one of his cards, "Where is Spiros Antonopoulos?" A nurse came into the room and he handed her the card. She did not understand. She shook her head and raised her shoulders. He went out into the corridor and handed the card to everyone he met. Nobody knew. There was such a panic in him that he began motioning with his hands. At last he met an intern in a white coat. He plucked at the intern's elbow and gave him the card. The intern read it carefully and then guided him through several halls. They came to a small room where a young woman sat at a desk before some papers. She read the card and then looked through some files in a drawer.
Tears of nervousness and fear swam in Singer's eyes. The young woman began deliberately to write on a pad of paper, and he could not restrain himself from twisting around to see immediately what was being written about his friend. Mr. Antonopoulos has been transferred to the infirmary. He is ill with nephritis. I will have someone show you the way. On the way through the corridors, he stopped to pick up the packages he had left at the door of the ward. The basket of fruit had been stolen, but the other boxes were intact. He followed the intern out of the building and across a plot of grass to the infirmary. Antonopoulos! When they reached the proper ward, he saw him at the first glance. His bed was placed in the middle of the room, and he was sitting propped with pillows. He wore a scarlet dressing gown and green silk pajamas and a turquoise ring. His skin was a pale yellow color, his eyes very dreamy and dark. His black hair was touched at the temples with silver. He was knitting. His fat fingers worked with the long ivory needles very slowly. At first he did not see his friend. Then when Singer stood before him, he smiled serenely, without surprise, and held out his jeweled hand. A feeling of shyness and restraint, such as he had never known before, came over Singer. He sat down by the bed and folded his hands on the edge of the counterpane. His eyes did not leave the face of his friend, and he was deathly pale. The splendor of his friend's raiment startled him. On various occasions he had sent him each article of the outfit, but he had not imagined how they would look when all combined. Antonopoulos was more enormous than he had remembered. The great pulpy folds of his abdomen showed beneath his silk pajamas. His head was immense against the white pillow. The placid composure of his face was so profound that he seemed hardly to be aware that Singer was with him. Singer raised his hands timidly and began to speak. His strong, skilled fingers shaped the signs with loving precision. He spoke of the cold and of the long months alone. He mentioned old memories, the cat that had died, the store, the place where he lived. At each pause, Antonopoulos nodded graciously. He spoke of the four people and the long visits to his room. The eyes of his friend were moist and dark, and in them he saw the little rectangled pictures of himself that he had watched 1,000 times. The warm blood flowed back to his face, and his hands quickened. He spoke at length of the black man, and the one with the jerking mustache, and the girl. The designs of his hands shaped faster and faster. Antonopoulos nodded with slow gravity. Eagerly Singer leaned closer, and he breathed with long, deep breaths, and in his eyes there were bright tears. Then suddenly Antonopoulos made a slow circle in the air with his plump forefinger. His finger circled toward Singer, and at last he poked his friend in the stomach. The big Greek smile grew very broad, and he stuck out his fat pink tongue. Singer laughed, and his hands shaped the words with wild speed. His shoulders shook with laughter, and his head hung backward. Why he laughed, he did not know. Antonopoulos rolled his eyes. Singer continued to laugh riotously until his breath was gone and his fingers trembled. He grasped the arm of his friend and tried to steady himself. His laughs came low and painfully like hiccups. Antonopoulos was the first to compose himself. His fat little feet had untucked the cover at the bottom of the bed. His smile faded, and he kicked contemptuously at the blanket. Singer hastened to put things right, but Antonopoulos frowned and held up his finger regally to a nurse who was passing through the ward. When she had straightened the bed to his liking, the big Greek inclined his head so deliberately that the gesture seemed one of benediction rather than a simple nod of thanks. Then he turned gravely to his friend again. As Singer talked, he did not realize how the time had passed. Only when a nurse brought Antonopoulos his supper on a tray did he realize that it was late. The lights in the ward were turned on, and outside the windows it was almost dark. The other patients had trays of supper before them also. They had put down their work, some of them wove baskets, others did leather work or knitted, and they were eating listlessly. Besides Antonopoulos, they all seemed very sick, and colorless. Most of them needed a haircut, and they wore seedy gray nightshirts slit down the back. They stared at the two mutes with wonder. Antonopoulos lifted the cover from his dish and inspected the food carefully. There was fish and some vegetables. He picked up the fish and held it to the light in the palm of his hand for a thorough examination. Then he ate with relish. During supper, he began to point out the various people in the room. He pointed to one man in the corner and made faces of disgust. The man snarled at him. He pointed to a young boy and smiled and nodded and waved his plump hand. Singer was too happy to feel embarrassment. He picked up the packages from the floor and laid them on the bed to distract his friend. Antonopoulos took off the wrappings, but the machine did not interest him at all. He turned back to his supper. Singer handed the nurse a note explaining about the movie. She called an intern, and then they brought in a doctor. As the three of them consulted, they looked curiously at Singer. The news reached the patients, and they propped up on their elbows excitedly. Only Antonopoulos was not disturbed. Singer had practiced with the movie beforehand. He set up the screen so that it could be watched by all the patients. Then he worked with the projector and the film. The nurse took out the supper trays, and the lights in the ward were turned off. A Mickey Mouse comedy flashed on the screen. Singer watched his friend. At first, Antonopoulos was startled. He heaved himself up for a better view and would have risen from the bed if the nurse had not restrained him. Then he watched with a beaming smile. Singer could see the other patients calling out to each other and laughing. Nurses and orderlies came in from the hall, and the whole ward was in commotion. When the Mickey Mouse was finished, Singer put on a Popeye film. Then at the conclusion of this film, he felt that the entertainment had lasted long enough for the first time. He switched on the light, and the ward settled down again. As the intern put the machine under his friend's bed, he saw Antonopoulos slyly cut his eyes across the ward to be certain that each person realized that the machine was his. Singer began to talk with his hands again. He knew that he would soon be asked to leave, but the thoughts he had stored in his mind were too big to be said in a short time. He talked with frantic haste. In the ward, there was an old man whose head shook with palsy and who picked feebly at his eyebrows. He envied the old man because he lived with Antonopoulos day after day. Singer would have exchanged places with him joyfully. His friend fumbled for something in his bosom. It was the little brass cross that he had always worn. The dirty string had been replaced by a red ribbon. Singer thought of the dream, and he told that also to his friend. In his haste, the sign sometimes became blurred, and he had to shake his hands and begin all over. Antonopoulos watched him with his dark, drowsy eyes. Sitting motionless in his bright, rich garments, he seemed like some wise king from a legend. The intern in charge of the ward allowed Singer to stay for an hour past the visiting time. Then at last he held out his thin, hairy wrist and showed him his watch. The patients were settled for sleep. Singer's hand faltered. He grasped his friend by the arm and looked intently into his eyes as he used to do each morning when they parted for work. Finally, Singer backed himself out of the room. At the doorway, his hand signed a broken farewell and then clenched into fists. During the moonlit January nights, Singer continued to walk about the streets of the town each evening when he was not engaged. The rumors about him grew bolder. An old Negro woman told hundreds of people that he knew the ways of spirits come back from the dead. A certain peace worker claimed that he had worked with the mute at another mill somewhere else in the state, and the tales he told were unique. The rich thought that he was rich, and the poor considered him a poor man like themselves. And as there was no way to disprove these rumors, they grew marvelous and very real. Each man described the mute as he wished him to be. 8. Why? The question flowed through Biff always, unnoticed, like the blood in his veins. He thought of people and of objects and of ideas, and the question was in him. Midnight, the dark morning, noon, Hitler and the rumors of war, the price of loin of pork and the tax on beer. Especially he meditated on the puzzle of the mute. Why, for instance, did Singer go away on the train and, when he was asked where he had been, pretend that he did not understand the question? And why did everyone persist in thinking that the mute was exactly as they wanted him to be, when most likely it was all a very queer mistake? Singer sat at the middle table 3 times a day. He ate what was put before him, except cabbage and oysters. In the battling tumult of voices, he alone was silent. He liked best little green soft butter beans, and he stacked them in a neat pile on the prongs of his fork, and supped their gravy with his biscuits. Biff thought also of death. A curious incident occurred. One day, while rummaging through the bathroom closet, he found a bottle of Agua Florida that he had overlooked when taking Lucille the rest of Alice's cosmetics. Meditatively, he held the bottle of perfume in his hands. It was 4 months now since her death, and each month seemed as long and full of leisure as a year. He seldom thought of her. Biff uncorked the bottle. He stood shirtless before the mirror and dabbled some of the perfume on his dark, hairy armpits. The scent made him stiffen. He exchanged a deadly secret glance with himself in the mirror and stood motionless. He was stunned by the memories brought to him with the perfume, not because of their clarity, but because they gathered together the whole long span of years and were complete. Biff rubbed his nose and looked sideways at himself. The boundary of death. He felt in him each minute that he had lived with her. And now their life together was whole as only the past can be whole. Abruptly, Biff turned away. The bedroom was done over, his entirely now. Before it had been tacky and flossy and drab. There were always stockings and pink rayon knickers with holes in them hung on a string across the room to dry. The iron bed had been flaked and rusty, decked with soiled lace boudoir pillows. A bony mouser from downstairs would arch its back and rub mournfully against the slop jar. All of this he had changed. He traded the iron bed for a studio couch. There was a thick red rug on the floor, and he had bought a beautiful cloth of Chinese blue to hang on the side of the wall where the cracks were worst. He had unsealed the fireplace and kept it laid with pine logs. Over the mantel was a small photograph of Baby and a colored picture of a little boy in velvet holding a ball in his hands. A glassed case in the corner held the curios he had collected. Specimens of butterflies, a rare arrowhead, a curious rock shaped like a human profile. Blue silk cushions were on the studio couch, and he had borrowed Lucille's sewing machine to make deep red curtains for the windows. He loved the room. It was both luxurious and sedate. On the table, there was a little Japanese pagoda with glass pendants that tinkled with strange musical tones in a draft. In this room, nothing reminded him of her. But often, he would uncork the bottle of Agua Florida and touch the stopper to the lobes of his ears or to his wrists. The smell mingled with his slow ruminations. The sense of the past grew in him. Memories built themselves with almost architectural order. In a box where he stored souvenirs, he came across old pictures taken before their marriage. Alice sitting in a field of daisies, Alice with him in a canoe on the river. Also among the souvenirs, there was a large bone hairpin that had belonged to his mother. As a little boy, he had loved to watch her comb and knot her long black hair. He had thought that hairpins were curved as they were to copy the shape of a lady, and he would sometimes play with them like dolls. At that time, he had a cigar box full of scraps. He loved the feel and colors of beautiful cloth, and he would sit with his scraps for hours under the kitchen table. But when he was six, his mother took the scraps away from him. She was a tall, strong woman with a sense of duty like a man. She had loved him best. Even now he sometimes dreamed of her, and her worn gold wedding ring stayed on his finger always. Along with the Agua Florida, he found in the closet a bottle of lemon rinse Alice had always used for her hair. One day he tried it on himself. The lemon made his dark, white-streaked hair seem fluffy and thick. He liked it. He discarded the oil he had used to guard against baldness and rinsed with the lemon preparation regularly. Certain whims that he had ridiculed in Alice were now his own. Why? Every morning, Lewis, the colored boy downstairs, brought him a cup of coffee to drink in bed. Often he sat propped on the pillows for an hour before he got up and dressed. He smoked a cigar and watched the patterns the sunlight made on the wall. Deep in meditation, he ran his forefinger between his long, crooked toes. He remembered. Then, from noon until 5 in the morning, he worked downstairs, and all day Sunday. The business was losing money. There were many slack hours. Still, at mealtimes, the place was usually full, and he saw hundreds of acquaintances every day as he stood guard behind the cash register.
"Well, what do you stand and think about all the time?" Jake Blunt asked him. "You look like a Jew in Germany."
"I am 1/8 Jew," Biff said. "My mother's grandfather was a Jew from Amsterdam, but all the rest of my folks that I know about were Scotch-Irish."
It was Sunday morning. Customers lolled at the tables, and there were the smell of tobacco and the rustle of newspaper. Some men in a corner booth shot dice, but the game was a quiet one.
"Where's Singer?" Biff asked. "Won't you be going up to his place this morning?"
Blunt's face turned dark and sullen. He jerked his head forward.
Had they quarreled?
But how could a dummy quarrel?
No, for this had happened before. Blunt hung around sometimes and acted as though he were having an argument with himself, but pretty soon he would go, he always did, and the two of them would come in together, Blunt talking.
"You live a fine life, just standing behind a cash register, just standing with your hand open."
Biff did not take offense. He leaned his weight on his elbows and narrowed his eyes.
"Let's me and you have a serious talk. What is it you want, anyway?"
Blunt smacked his hands down on the counter. They were warm and meaty and rough.
"Beer, and one of them little packages of cheese crackers with peanut butter in the inside."
"That's not what I meant," Biff said, "but we'll come around to it later."
The man was a puzzle. He was always changing. He still drank like a crazy fish, but liquor did not drag him down as it did some men. The rims of his eyes were often red, and he had a nervous trick of looking back startled over his shoulder. His head was heavy and huge on his thin neck. He was the sort of fellow that kids laughed at and dogs wanted to bite. Yet when he was laughed at, it cut him to the quick. He got rough and loud like a sort of clown, and he was always suspecting that somebody was laughing. Biff shook his head thoughtfully.
"Come," he said, "what makes you stick with that show? You can find something better than that. I could give you a part-time job here." "Christ almighty, I wouldn't park myself behind that cash box if you was to give me the whole damn place, lock, stock, and barrel."
There he was. It was irritating. He could never have friends or even get along with people.
"Talk sense," Biff said. "Be serious."
A customer had come up with his check and he made change. The place was still quiet. Blunt was restless. Biff felt him drawing away. He wanted to hold him. He reached for 2 A1 cigars on the shelf behind the counter and offered Blunt a smoke. Warily, his mind dismissed one question after another, and then finally he asked,
"If you could choose the time in history you could have lived, what era would you choose?"
Blunt licked his mustache with his broad, wet tongue.
"If you had to choose between being a stiff and never asking another question, which would you take?"
"Sure enough," Biff insisted. "Think it over." He cocked his head to one side and peered down over his long nose. This was a matter he liked to hear others talk about.
Ancient Greece was his, walking in sandals on the edge of the blue Aegean, the loose robes girdled at the waist, children, the marble baths and the contemplations in the temples.
Maybe with the Incas in Peru.
Biff's eyes scanned over him, stripping him naked. He saw Blunt burned a rich red-brown by the sun, his face smooth and hairless, with a bracelet of gold and precious stones on his forearm. When he closed his eyes, the man was a good Inca, but when he looked at him again, the picture fell away. It was the nervous mustache that did not belong to his face, the way he jerked his shoulder, the Adam's apple on his thin neck, the bagginess of his trousers, and it was more than that.
Or maybe around 1775.
Now that was a good time to be living, Biff agreed. Blunt shuffled his feet self-consciously. His face was rough and unhappy. He was ready to leave. Biff was alert to detain him.
Tell me, why did you ever come to this town anyway?
He knew immediately that the question had not been a politic one, and he was disappointed with himself. Yet it was queer how the man could land up in a place like this.
It's the God's truth. I don't know.
They stood quietly for a moment, both leaning on the counter. The game of dice in the corner was finished. The first dinner order, a Long Island duck special, had been served to the fellow who managed the A&P store. The radio was turned halfway between a church sermon and a swing band. Blunt leaned over suddenly and smelled Biff's face.
Perfume?
Shaving lotion, Biff said composedly. He could not keep Blunt longer. The fellow was ready to go. He would come in with Singer later. It was always like this. He wanted to draw Blunt out completely so that he could understand certain questions concerning him, but Blunt would never really talk, only to the mute. It was a most peculiar thing.
Thanks for the cigar, Blunt said. See you later.
So long. Biff watched Blunt walk to the door with his rolling, sailor-like gait, and he took up the duties before him. He looked over the display in the window. The day's menu had been pasted on the glass, and a special dinner with all the trimmings was laid out to attract customers. It looked bad, right nasty. The gravy from the duck had run into the cranberry sauce, and a fly was stuck in the dessert.
Hey, Lewis, he called. Take this stuff out of the window and bring me that red pottery bowl and some fruit.
He arranged the fruits with an eye for color and design. At last, the decoration pleased him. He visited the kitchen and had a talk with the cook. He lifted the lids of the pots and sniffed the food inside, but without heart for the matter. Alice always had done this part. He disliked it. His nose sharpened when he saw the greasy sink with its scum of food bits at the bottom. He wrote down the menus and the orders for the next day. He was glad to leave the kitchen and take his stand by the cash register again. Lucille and Baby came for Sunday dinner. The little kid was not so good now. The bandage was still on her head, and the doctor said it could not come off until next month. The binding of gauze in place of the yellow curls made her head look naked.
Say hello to Uncle Biff, hon, Lucille prompted.
Baby bridled fretfully.
Hello to Uncle Biff, hon, she sassed.
She put up a struggle when Lucille tried to take off her Sunday coat.
Now you just behave yourself, Lucille kept saying. You got to take it off or you'll catch pneumonia when we go out again. Now you just behave yourself.
Biff took the situation in charge. He soothed Baby with a ball of candy gum and eased the coat from her shoulders. Her dress had lost its set in the struggle with Lucille. He straightened it so that the yoke was in line across her chest. He retied her sash and crushed the bow to just the right shape with his fingers. Then he patted Baby on her little behind. We got some strawberry ice cream today, he said.
Bartholomew, you'd make a mighty good mother.
Thanks, Biff said. That's a compliment.
We just been to Sunday school and church. Baby, say the verse from the Bible you learned for your Uncle Biff.
The kid hung back and pouted.
Jesus
whipped,
she said finally. The scorn that she put in the two words made it sound like a terrible thing. Want to see Lewis? Biff asked. He's back in the kitchen.
I want to see Willie. I want to hear Willie play the harp.
Now, baby, you're just trying yourself,
Lucille said impatiently.
You know good and well that Willie's not here. Willie was sent off to the penitentiary.
But Lewis, Biff said, he can play the harp, too. Go tell him to get the ice cream ready and play you a tune. Baby went toward the kitchen, dragging one heel on the floor. Lucille laid her hat on the counter. There were tears in her eyes.
You know, I always said this. If a child is kept clean and well cared for and pretty, then that child will usually be sweet and smart. But if a child's dirty and ugly, then you can't expect anything much. And what I'm trying to get at is that Baby is so shamed over losing her hair and that bandage on her head that it just seems like it makes her cut the buck all the time. She won't practice her elocution. She won't do a thing. She feels so bad, I just can't manage her.
If you quit picking with her so much, she'd be all right. At last, he settled them in a booth by the window. Lucille had a special, and there was a breast of chicken cut up fine, cream of wheat and carrots for Baby. She played with her food and spilled milk on her little frock. He sat with them until the rush started. Then he had to be on his feet to keep things going smoothly. People eating, the wide-open mouths with the food pushed in. What was it? The line he had read not long ago. Life was only a matter of intake and alimentation and reproduction. The place was crowded. There was a swing band on the radio. Then the two he was waiting for came in. Singer entered the door first, very straight and swank in his tailored Sunday suit. Blunt followed along just behind his elbow. There was something about the way they walked that struck him. They sat at their table, and Blunt talked and ate with gusto while Singer watched politely. When the meal was finished, they stopped by the cash register for a few minutes. Then as they went out, he noticed again there was something about their walking together that made him pause and question himself. What could it be? The suddenness with which the memory opened up deep down in his mind was a shock. The big, deaf-mute moron whom Singer used to walk with sometimes on the way to work. The sloppy Greek who made candy for Charles Parker. The Greek always walked ahead, and Singer followed. He had never noticed them much because they never came into the place. But why had he not remembered this? Of all the times he had wondered about the mute, to neglect such an angle. See everything in the landscape except the three waltzing elephants. But did it matter after all? Biff narrowed his eyes. How Singer had been before was not important. The thing that mattered was the way Blunt and Mick made of him a sort of homemade god. Owing to the fact he was a mute, they were able to give him all the qualities they wanted him to have. Yes, but how could such a strange thing come about? And why? A one-armed man came in, and Biff treated him to a whiskey on the house. But he did not feel like talking to anyone. Sunday dinner was a family meal. Men who drank beer by themselves on weeknights brought their wives and little kids with them on Sunday. The high chair they kept in the back was often needed. It was 2:30, and though many tables were occupied, the meal was almost over. Biff had been on his feet for the past 4 hours and was tired. He used to stand for 14 or 16 hours and not notice any effects at all. But now he had aged. Considerably. There was no doubt about it. Or maybe matured was the word, not aged. Certainly not. Yet. The waves of sound in the room swelled and subsided against his ears. Matured. His eyes smarted, and it was as though some fever in him made everything too bright and sharp. He called out to one of the waitresses, "Take over for me, will you, please? I'm going out." The street was empty because of Sunday. The sun shone bright and clear without warmth. Biff held the collar of his coat close to his neck. Alone in the street, He felt out of pocket. The wind blew cold from the river. He should turn back and stay in the restaurant where he belonged. He had no business going to the place where he was headed. For the past 4 Sundays, he had done this. He had walked in the neighborhood where he might see Mick. And there was something about it that was not quite right. Yes. Wrong. He walked slowly down the sidewalk opposite the house where she lived. Last Sunday, she'd been reading the funny papers on the front steps, but this time, as he glanced swiftly toward the house, he saw she was not there. Biff tilted the brim of his felt hat down over his eyes. Perhaps she would come into the place later. Often on Sunday after supper, she came for a hot cocoa and stopped for a while at the table where Singer was sitting. On Sunday, she wore a different outfit from the blue skirt and sweater she wore on other days. Her Sunday dress was wine-colored silk with a gingy lace collar. Once she had had on stockings with runs in them. Always, he wanted to set her up to something, to give to her. And not only a Sunday or some sweet to eat, but something real. That was all he wanted for himself, to give to her. Biff's mouth hardened. He had done nothing wrong, but in him, he felt a strange guilt. Why? The dark guilt in all men, unreckoned and without a name. On the way home, Biff found a penny lying half-concealed by rubbish in the gutter. Thriftily, he picked it up, cleaned the coin with his handkerchief, and dropped it into the black pocket purse he carried. It was 4 o'clock when he reached the restaurant. Business was stagnant. There was not a single customer in the place. Business picked up around 5. The boy he had recently hired to work part-time showed up early. The boy's name was Harry Minowitz. He lived in the same neighborhood with Mick and Baby. 11 applicants had answered the ad in the paper, but Harry seemed to be the best bet. He was well-developed for his age and neat. Biff had noticed the boy's teeth while talking to him during the interview. Teeth were always a good indication. His were large and very clean and white. Harry wore glasses, but that would not matter in the work. His mother made $10 a week sewing for a tailor down the street, and Harry was an only child. "Well," Biff said, "you've been with me a week, Harry. Think you're gonna like it?" "Sure, sir. Sure, I like it." Biff turned the ring on his finger. "Let's see. What time do you get off from school?"
3 o'clock, sir."
"Well, that gives you a couple of hours for study and recreation, then here from 6 to 10. Does that leave you enough time for plenty of sleep?"
"Plenty. I don't need near that much."
"Well, you need about 9.5 hours at your age, son. Pure, wholesome sleep." He felt suddenly embarrassed. Maybe Harry would think it was none of his business, which it wasn't, anyway. He started to turn aside and then thought of something. "You go to vocational?" Harry nodded and rubbed his glasses on his shirt sleeve. "Let's see. I know a lot of girls and boys there. Alva Richards, I know his father, and Maggie Henry, and a kid named Mick Kelly." He felt as though his ears had caught a fire. He knew himself to be a fool. He wanted to turn and walk away, and yet he only stood there, smiling and mashing his nose with his thumb. "You know her?" he asked faintly.
"Sure. I live right next door to her. But in school I'm a senior while she's a freshman."
Biff stored this meager information neatly in his mind to be thought over later when he was alone. "Business will be quiet here for a while," he said hurriedly. "I'll leave it with you. By now you know how to handle things. Just watch any customers drinking beer and remember how many they've drunk so you won't have to ask them and depend on what they say. Take your time making change and keep track of what goes on." Biff shut himself in his room downstairs. This was the place where he kept his files. The room had only one small window and looked out on the side alley, and the air was musty and cold. Huge stacks of newspapers rose up to the ceiling. A homemade filing case covered one wall. Near the door, there was an old-fashioned rocking chair and a small table laid with a pair of shears, a dictionary, and a mandolin. Because of the piles of newspaper, it was impossible to take more than 2 steps in any direction. Biff rocked himself in the chair and languidly plucked the strings of the mandolin. His eyes closed, and he began to sing in a doleful voice. I went to the animal fair. The birds and the beasts were there, and the old baboon, by the light of the moon, was combing his auburn hair. He finished with a chord from the strings, and the last sound shivered to silence in the cold air. To adopt a couple of little children, a boy and a girl, about 3 or 4 years old, so they would always feel like he was their own father, their dad, our father. The little girl like Mick, or baby, at that age, round cheeks and gray eyes and flaxen hair, and the clothes he would make for her, pink crepe de chine frocks with dainty smocking at the yoke and sleeves, silk socks and white buckskin shoes, and a little red velvet coat and cap and muff for winter. The boy was dark and black-haired. The little boy walked behind him and copied the things he did. In the summer, the three of them would go to a cottage on the Gulf, and he would dress the children in their sun suits and guide them carefully into the green, shallow waves. And then they would bloom as he grew old, our father, and they would come to him with questions, and he would answer them. Why not? Biff took up his mandolin again. Tum, ta-tim, ta-tee, ta-tee, the wedding of the painted doll. The mandolin mocked the refrain. He sang through all the verses and wagged his foot to the time. Then he played K-K-K-Katie and Love's Old Sweet Song. These pieces were like the Agua Florida in the way they made him remember everything. Through the first year, when he was happy and when she seemed happy even too, and when the bed came down with them twice in 3 months. And he didn't know that all the time her brain was busy with how she could save a nickel or squeeze out an extra dime. And then him with Rio and the girls at her place, Jip and Madeline and Lou, and then later when suddenly he lost it, when he could lie with a woman no longer. Mother of God. So that at first it seemed everything was gone. Lucille always understood the whole setup. She knew the kind of woman Alice was. Maybe she knew about him, too. Lucille would urge them to get a divorce, and she did all a person could to try to straighten out their messes. Biff winced suddenly. He jerked his hands from the strings of the mandolin so that a phrase of music was chopped off. He sat tense in his chair. Then suddenly he laughed quietly to himself. What had made him come across this? Ah, oh, lordy, lordy, lord. It was the day of his 29th birthday, and Lucille had asked him to drop by her apartment when he finished with an appointment at the dentist's. He expected from this some little remembrance, a plate of cherry tarts or a good shirt. She met him at the door and blindfolded his eyes before he entered. Then she said she would be back in a second. In the silent room, he listened to her footsteps, and when she had reached the kitchen, he broke wind. He stood in the room with his eyes blindfolded and pooted. Then all at once, he knew with horror he was not alone. There was a little titter, and soon great rolling whoops of laughter deafened him. At that minute, Lucille came back and undid his eyes. She held a caramel cake on a platter. The room was full of people. Leroy and that bunch and Alice, of course. He wanted to crawl up the wall. He stood there with his bare face hanging out, burning hot all over. They kidded him, and the next hour was almost as bad as the death of his mother, the way he took it. Later that night, he drank a quart of whiskey, and for weeks after, mother of God. Biff chuckled coldly. He plucked a few chords on his mandolin and started a rollicking cowboy song. His voice was a mellow tenor, and he closed his eyes as he sang. The room was almost dark. The damp chill penetrated to his bones so that his legs ached with rheumatism. At last, he put away his mandolin and rocked slowly in the darkness. Death. Sometimes he could almost feel it in the room with him. He rocked to and fro in the chair. What did he understand? Nothing. Where was he headed? Nowhere. What did he want? To know. What? A A meaning. Why? A riddle. Broken pictures lay like a scattered jigsaw puzzle in his head. Alice soaping in the bathtub. Mussolini's mug. Mick pulling the baby in a wagon. A roast turkey on display. Blunt's mouth. The face of Singer. He felt himself waiting. The room was completely dark. From the kitchen, he could hear Lewis singing. Biff stood up and touched the arm of his chair to still its rocking. When he opened the door, the hall outside was very warm and bright. He remembered that perhaps Mick would come. He straightened his clothes and smoothed back his hair. A warmth and liveliness returned to him. The restaurant was in a hubbub. Beer rounds and Sunday supper had begun. He smiled genially to young Harry and settled himself behind the cash register. He took in the room with a glance like a lasso. The place was crowded and humming with noise. The bowl of fruit in the window was a genteel, artistic display. He watched the door and continued to examine the room with a practiced eye. He was alert and intently waiting. Singer came, finally, and wrote with his silver pencil that he wanted only soup and whiskey, as he had a cold. But Mick did not come.